This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. So far, so good. The ceasefire agreement reached between Israel and Hamas last month is largely holding, while the exchange of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners is proceeding with only a few hitches. The releases have been staggered, with 18 hostages let go by Hamas and busloads of Palestinian prisoners released by Israel, while hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been returning to what were once their homes in what is now the wasteland of Gaza. In addition, aid into Gaza has been resumed. This phase of the agreement, which began on January the 19th, is meant to last 6 weeks, but negotiations on phase two are meant to start tomorrow, except that negotiator Qatar says there are no clear plans to do so at the moment. But Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is off to Washington to begin talks on the second phase with President Trump. Here's what he had to say earlier today, just before taking off for Washington.
I'm leaving for a very important meeting with President Trump in Washington. The fact that this would be President Trump's first meeting with a foreign leader since his inauguration is telling. We'll deal with the important issues, critical issues facing Israel and our region, a victory over Hamas, achieving the release of all our hostages, and dealing with the Iranian terror axis and all its components. I believe that we can strengthen security, broaden the circle of peace, and achieve a remarkable era of peace through strength.
Well, let's hear now from the BBC's Wira Davis in Jerusalem. And Wira, a somewhat triumphant sounding Mr. Netanyahu boarding the plane for Washington.
Yeah, but I think this could be quite a tricky visit for him, because the consensus here on the ground, as you were saying in the introduction, is that the ceasefire itself is producing results. Lots of hostages and Palestinians prisoners exchanged. The Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza has been partially opened, allowing very sick children out for treatment abroad. And the consensus, I think, in Israeli society and in Palestinian circles is that it should continue. Yet Mr. Netanyahu is being pressured by people from his far right, including ministers in his government, to stop the ceasefire after this first phase and resume the war against Hamas in Gaza. And President Trump, remember, this was partially his ceasefire deal. He sent his envoy even before he was president to negotiate the ceasefire deal, and he won't want to see the ceasefire deal collapse. So I think if there is any inkling that allies of Netanyahu in Israel are trying to sabotage the ceasefire, it'll be interesting to see what Mr. Trump's reaction is, because, of course, he has his eyes on an even bigger prize in the Middle East for him, which is the extension of the Abraham Accords with Saudi Arabia. So it might be a bit more tense, this meeting, than you might initially think.
And is there any concern in Israel that there's been no formal announcement about a resumption of talks on phase two?
It's early days yet. There are nearly 4 weeks to go before the end of phase one and the resumption and the start of phase two, when more hostages and prisoners would be released. Israeli troops would retreat even further from where they are in Gaza, and would start to talk about the end of the war. Now there's a while to go, but Mr. Netanyahu's version of events is that they will start to talk about it in Washington on Monday. He will lay out his plans as he sees it to American negotiators. At some point later in the week, maybe the other negotiators like Qatar and Egypt will get involved. But it's the start of a process that, doesn't have to really come into force for maybe 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Wira, many thanks. That was the BBC's Wira Davis there, live from Jerusalem. And let's hear now from Frank Lowenstein, who served as the US Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from June 2014 until January 2017. He's on the line from Washington, D.C. And Mr. Lowenstein, you will probably have heard Wira there alluding to the fact that maybe Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump have slightly different agendas for the future of this peace process.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, this meeting comes at a critical point for the ceasefire, the most difficult negotiations, which would be required to be resolved in order to really extend the ceasefire and permanently end the war. Those are going to begin after the meeting between Netanyahu and Trump. In fact, Netanyahu specifically delayed them until he returned. And we may find that his agenda is really at odds with President Trump's agenda. I mean, both of these guys have long been committed to really advancing their own personal and political agendas first and foremost. And Trump's political agenda is to end the war and normalize relations with Saudi Arabia. And Netanyahu, I don't think, had any intention of extending the ceasefire. He's apparently made promises to his coalition members that, in fact, he will resume the war. And that very much serves his own personal and political interests. So we'll see what happens. Traditionally, Netanyahu has tried to intimidate U.S. presidents and to bully them politically. But I think he fears President Trump in a way he's maybe never feared of U.S. president before. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out.
So you do believe that Mr. Trump's view might prevail?
Well, I think that he's likely to prevail, in at least in the rhetoric coming out of the meeting. I don't think Trump is going to want to have a fight with Netanyahu publicly on Tuesday or vice versa. The real challenge will come when the negotiations begin on resolving the issues that will be required to really end the war. And I know Hamas is still a very powerful military force on the ground. Netanyahu has promised that he's going to completely eliminate Hamas. He's talked about total victory. That is inconsistent with actually ending the war right now. So my guess is that Netanyahu will play for time, and then he'll claim that the Hamas folks are being impossible in the negotiations and try to shift the blame to them over time. Whether he moves back from that position will depend in large part on how much pressure Trump is willing to put on him politically.
Because in fact, Mr. Netanyahu hasn't yet spelled out his terms for the end of the war. I mean, he's spoken before of defeating Hamas, and as you've alluded to, we've seen Hamas militants as a startling presence on the streets of Gaza during the hostage handover.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think the only way that the war can actually end in accordance with the ceasefire is if the Israelis are willing to agree upon some kind of day after plan that involves an international peacekeeping force and some form of Palestinian governance inside of Gaza Strip. And that will really need to include the Palestinian Authority if the region is to get on board. And Netanyahu has been adamant that he will never allow that to happen. And in fact, he's really done nothing in terms of suggesting what a post-war plan would look like. So he's really going to have to resolve some very difficult issues substantively and politically if he's going to be able to move this forward.
I mean, there seems to be a general consensus that the second phase of this ceasefire agreement is likely to be the most problematic. How do you see it collapsing, if indeed it does?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's a fairly good chance that this first phase, lasting another 30 days or so, will be implemented in full, and the Israelis will get about a third of the hostages back. The transition from phase one to phase two requires a permanent end to the war. So you'll never even get to phase two unless there's agreement on ending the war, you know, for as far as the eye can see. And in order to do that, there just has to be this alternative to Hamas, which I don't think Netanyahu has any intention of really wrestling with that issue. So you could get to the end of the 42-day period and Netanyahu would just say the Hamas has been impossible to deal with on all these negotiations. And then the ceasefire would slowly grind to a halt and the war would resume. I think that would be the easiest path for Netanyahu politically. And as I said, I think the only way he'll do anything different than that is if he's feeling a lot of pressure from Trump.
Mr. Lowenstein, many thanks. That was Frank Lowenstein, who served in the as the United States Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from June 2014 until January 2017. It's coming up for 2 years in Sudan since two rival warlords and their supporters started fighting each other. What began as a battle for control of the capital has become a battle for control of the entire country between the head of the army, General Burhan, and General Hameti, who leads the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary. And with each passing month, atrocities against the civilian population have mounted. Among the latest is the shelling on Saturday of a market in Omdurman, twin city of Khartoum, which has killed more than 60 people and injured dozens of others. The casualties were taken to Al Naw Hospital in Omdurman, which was being visited at the time by Chris Lockyer, General Secretary of the medical charity MSF.
Well, the scenes in Al Naw hospital in Omdurman just yesterday were catastrophic. I mean, the emergency room was just full of patients needing urgent treatment. The outpatient department was full of walking wounded. There were more patients being brought in as I arrived, and there were dead bodies going in the opposite direction. Outside the morgue was a pile of dead bodies in body bags. And as I was there, I mean, obviously there were people wailing because of the loss of loved ones. There was also people walking around the emergency room checking on individual patients to see if it was one of their relatives that were lying there.
So dozens of injured, with injuries consistent with shelling?
Yeah, what happened was a shell hit at a marketplace, and some of the injured were as a direct consequence of that shelling. Other patients because of the chaos and the disruption in that marketplace. So it was all elements of society who were out shopping were part of the casualties yesterday. And so I've seen men, I've seen women, I've seen children.
The hospital is able to offer what kind of treatment to the patients? I mean, I just wondered what sort of medicines are available at the moment.
Supplies are really lacking. There was rationing of paracetamol, so even basic painkillers were in short supply. And there's a desperate need for basic medical supplies such as gauze for stopping blood flow. This is, I think, the third time in the last couple of months where they've had to deal with a mass casualty event. And there are some hospitals which are just a few kilometers from here, which we can't yet reach because of the difficulty to cross front lines, where we have reports of other severe mass casualty events just in the last 4 or 5 days. And so we're really trying to be able to get to those places as well, to be able to support them.
Are you in touch with the combatants in any way?
Yes, we're in contact with both sides of this conflict. It's how we try and operate in any conflict around the world. In fact, one of the reasons I'm in Sudan at the moment is to be making and developing those contacts and discussing how we can operate in this very, very dynamic conflict, which is changing by the day. So as a matter of modality, we try and seek to be in contact with those who are fighting here and anywhere in the world.
I mean, it's obviously not your job to mediate in any way, but I mean, do you try to impress upon the combatants the consequences of their actions, such as you witnessed at the hospital yesterday?
Absolutely. And we want to be talking about the horrific things we're seeing. This war is a war on civilians. It has been going on for nearly 2 years now, in which the civilians have been clearly the main victims of this conflict, and whether that's through direct shelling that we saw yesterday or whether that's because of huge rates of malnutrition throughout Sudan, but particularly in Darfur. We want to speak to the combatants and tell them this is the consequence of your actions.
That was Chris Lockyer. And coming up, the Grammy Awards will be held in Los Angeles in the next few hours, but it's a time when many are still recovering from the devastating wildfires in the city.
I actually don't think that the Grammys should be happening. It's just very weird to me that there are going to be celebrities, you know, walking on the red carpet wearing very expensive clothes while people in other parts of the city are suffering and whose livelihoods have been destroyed.
And the latest headlines from the BBC newsroom, the US Secretary of State has told Panama Washington will take action unless there are changes to how the canal is operated. But President Mulino said he saw no real threat. More on that in about 15 minutes. And President Trump has said any pain brought by the tariffs he's imposed on America's biggest trading partners will be worth it in the long run. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. The Spanish women's football team celebrating winning the World Cup in Australia in 2023 after they beat England in the final. But it's what happened on the winners' podium that night that has somewhat overshadowed their victory. On Monday in Spain, the former president of the country's football federation, Luis Rubiales, will go on trial to face charges of sexual assault on that day in 2023. Mr. Rubiales sparked controversy in Spain and indeed around the world when he kissed a member of that Spanish team on the lips after the final had ended. This is what the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez had to say about the incident at the time.
The behavior of Mr. Rubiales in this case shows that, in our country, there is still a long way to go when it comes to equality and respect between women and men.
We're joining us from Madrid is the BBC's Guy Hedgeco. And Guy, firstly, could you remind us of the furore that followed that kiss?
Yes, I mean, very soon after the kiss took place, there was a very strong backlash against Mr. Rubiales back here in Spain. A social backlash. There were people taking to the streets to protest against him and to demand that he be removed as president of the federation. There were politicians who waded into this. We heard Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez speaking there, but there were other politicians from across the political spectrum who also spoke out, almost all of them criticizing Mr. Rubiales. And overall, there was a feeling that this had really overshadowed a major achievement by the women's team. It was a controversy which dragged on for quite a long time and which obviously is now being talked about a lot again.
Why has it come to trial?
Well, it's come to trial because the public prosecutor decided there was a case here. There was an investigation carried out into this by the investigating judge to decide whether this could go to trial. The judge decided that there was enough evidence to put Mr. Rubiales on trial, not just for sexual assault, for that kiss that he gave Jenny Hermoso, but also for coercion, for allegedly trying to force Jenny Hermoso to support his version of events so that to try and make her say that there was consent when he kissed her, when she had said there wasn't. So he's going on trial for those two charges. And there are also three other former members of the Federation, allies of Mr. Rubiales, who will also be facing those coercion charges as well.
And what has Mr. Rubiales said in his defence?
Well, he said that it was a consensual kiss. He said that there's no case here. He hasn't done anything wrong. He said that he actually asked Jenny Hermoso if he could kiss her beforehand. He said she said that he could. So he said there's no case to be answered here as far as he's concerned. And when this whole controversy blew up, he in fact said that it was being stirred up by false feminists, as he put it. So he has spoken out very strongly against the case being made against him with this trial.
Guy, many thanks. That was the BBC's Guy Hedgeco speaking from Madrid. Bill Gates, the co-founder of Microsoft, has taken a very different path to some of the other swaggering tech billionaires. The Gates Foundation is now the biggest charitable organisation in the world, fighting poverty, disease and inequity. And Mr. Gates is now seeking to further cement his legacy with a trilogy of memoirs, the first of which is called Source Code, and which reveals that he thinks he would nowadays be diagnosed as neurodiverse. Our culture and media editor, Katie Razzle, met him at his former family home in Seattle on the northwest coast of the United States.
How do you play Pounce?
Pounce, you put four cards out.
Bill Gates and his sisters, Christy and Libby.
13. I think it's either 11 or 13.
I think it's 11.
Are teaching me one of the childhood card games they used to play with their grandmother. He credits her with teaching him to outsmart the competition early on.
You can play out onto these cards.
And the idea is to get rid of this pile.
What are your memories of Bill as a child?
He was sort of introverted, basically.
This is his elder sister, Christy.
He spent a lot of time thinking, it appeared to be.
I suppose it was normal to you because it was your brother. But
yeah, I did, that's the only boy that I knew, so I thought boys were like that.
Did you have any sense back then of how he seemed different?
Yeah, he was not a normal kid. He would like sit in his room and chew pencils down to the lead, which...
Good for you.
As Bill Gates publishes a memoir, Source Code, about his beginnings, he's taken me back to his childhood home. He hasn't visited since it was sold after his father died, and it's bringing back memories.
My sisters lived down here. This was kind of ping pong game type room. And then my room is down here. This is where I grew up.
The key thing about this bedroom, for me anyway, is that that is the window that you used to climb out of.
You know, computers, it was very hard to get access to them. And I wanted to spend as much time as I could. So at night, I could sneak out and go up, use the computer, and then sneak back in without them knowing.
In the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Do you think you could still do it?
Well, it's not that hard.
And with that, he opens the window.
Oh, my.
And climbs through.
It's not hard at all.
That's it. He's out. And he's off to find a computer.
Yeah, that way.
Back then, young Bill and his increasingly tech-savvy school friends had a deal with a local company to check its one computer for problems in return for time on it. He'd first got access to a computer via his old school lakeside, where we're now heading.
The school deserves credit. It was their mother's club that had a rummage sale that put the money to this bizarre idea of having a terminal that you could call in to a big computer.
And you got hooked immediately.
And so you see, this is me here in the computer room. This
you
is.
Look so lovely.
We're walking towards what's archly referred to as the shrine. Behind glass doors, there are photos and other memorabilia, a homage to Gates and his Microsoft co-founder, Paul Allen, who was a school friend.
So this is the actual teletype. That's not actually a computer, but it connects over a phone line to a computer. Computers were so expensive that you could never afford one, but we got a little bit of time, and so you would prepare your program and then call into the computer.
So this was the machine that you were first writing code on?
Yes. We would spend hour after hour sitting there at this machine.
Did it feel like an addiction?
It was an obsession.
You say now you think you would probably be diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Have you had a formal diagnosis?
No, I have not.
Do you plan to?
No, I mean, it's not like there's some medicine that, you know, when you get this diagnosis, you take it and then, you know, your social skills are fantastic. And, you know, I'm not sure I'd want that. I think I wouldn't, because the positive characteristics for my career have been more beneficial than the deficits have been a problem for me.
That was Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates speaking to our culture and media editor, Katie Razzle. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. You're with NewsHour. Tarot, the set of playing cards illustrated with mysterious symbols, has been popular for hundreds of years. The cards have also been widely used to tell people's fortunes, and now they're having a cultural revival. The BBC's Robin Banerjee has been along to the Warburg Institute in London to see a show on the history of these mysterious cards with the Institute's director.
So I'm here at the Warburg Institute with Bill Sherman. Bill, we are at the beginning of tarot here, aren't we, in this part of the gallery. What are we looking at?
Literally. It starts in Renaissance Italy, like many good things, and it has nothing to do with magic. Here we have four cards from about the 1450s.
What are we looking at here? There are four cards, and they're cards from a card game. That's right, isn't it?
Tarot is still a game played with cards in similar structure to the modern playing cards that most of us use when we're playing anything like poker or blackjack. However, you have the addition of 21 symbolic cards. Those cards are called trumps, and they trump other cards.
Where are you taking us to now?
I'm taking you to late 18th century France, because what happens, remarkably enough, is a card game suddenly becomes occult. And in the 1780s, there was a great obsession with recovering putative connections to ancient Egypt. So this lineage, all the way back to the ancient world, is invented at a table by a Freemason named Court de Gabelin. And Court de Gabelin basically says, watching these people play this card game, he suddenly realized that they preserved and captured an ancient wisdom tradition stretching all the way back to ancient Egypt.
We've come to the final room now. It's a small little room within the exhibition, and it's full of, well, these are more like cards.
And what we've tried to assemble here is about 10 of the most interesting and provocative uses of tarot by artists and activists today. Here, for instance, we have the Black Power Tarot, has figures from African American convention and mythology.
We've got James Brown as L'Amoureux, the lovers. He's between two young ladies.
Tupac, he's hanging down. Hanged man.
Yeah, Tupac is the hangman, and he's still sagging his jeans, even though he's hanging upside
even
down.
This deck below here, the so-called lockdown tarot, made during lockdown, has what is probably now, at least this week, my favorite tarot card, which is the Trump. So Donald Trump himself is represented as a Trump card, and he is the king of vaccines.
And that was Bill Sherman, director of the Warburg Institute in London, talking to the BBC's Robin Bellegy. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has met Panama's president on his first overseas trip as America's top diplomat, and he'll certainly need all his diplomatic skills to explain why President Trump has threatened to seize control of, with force if necessary, of the Panama Canal, the internationally used waterway in Panama that connects the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. Mr. Trump first made the threat in his inauguration speech last month. He claims that China has undue influence over the canal, which was built by the United States but handed over to Panama in a treaty 25 years ago.
We have been treated very badly from this foolish gift that should have never been made, and Panama's promise to us has been broken. The purpose of our deal and the spirit of our treaty has been totally violated. American ships are being severely overcharged and not treated fairly in any way, shape, or form, and that includes the United States Navy. And above all, China is operating the Panama Canal, and we didn't give it to China, we gave it to Panama, and we're taking it back.
Well, Panama has previously insisted that its control over the canal is not negotiable. And following their talks today, both President Mulino and Marco Rubio took a tough line with little indication of the dispute being resolved. Let's talk to our correspondent, Tom Bateman, who's in Panama City. And Tom, Marco Rubio, maintaining Donald Trump's position on China's influence on the canal.
He is. And I think what we've seen actually over the course of the last few hours is a sharp escalation in this standoff, because Mr. Rubio held a two-hour meeting with President Mulino in Panama City, after which the State Department issued a very strong statement in his name, which basically said that President Trump had determined that China was involved in influence and control over the canal, which it says is unacceptable, and called for Panama to take immediate action. Or this statement says that the U.S. will take necessary measures to protect its treaty obligations. And I think here in Panama, that is going to be interpreted basically as a threat, an ultimatum. The Panamanian president came out of that meeting saying that he felt secure that this wasn't a threat of military action to seize the canal by the United States. But clearly it is causing, and I've been speaking to people here over the last few days, ordinary Panamanians, people are quite worried and concerned about this. And memories are close to the surface of the U.S. invasion of Panama back in 1989. And so we have a diplomatic standoff, far from resolved through this visit, but seems to be escalating sharply.
And President Molina, would it be true to say that he has made some concessions?
He certainly has. Ever since President Trump was elected, there has been a series of measures executed by Mr. Molina to effectively push back China's economic influence in this country. For example, the building of some train infrastructure that has been handed off, or at least sort of delayed, and the Chinese influence said to be not as great now. So I think they're trying to show that they are listening. And what Mr. Molina has talked about is technical talks with the US to come to some form of agreement. I think they're trying to downscale this, or they're trying to at least get a ladder that they can come down on. But the rhetoric so far from the US side is not matching that, and is much more about ultimatum.
Tom, many thanks. That was our correspondent Tom Bateman speaking live there from Panama City. And let's speak now to Michael Shifter, who's a senior fellow of the US-based think tank Inter-American Dialogue. He's on the line from Washington. And it doesn't appear that either Marco Rubio or Donald Trump are satisfied with what President Molina has told them about the independence of the port. And, not the absence of Chinese influence, but that, in fact, that influence is minimal. Michael? Nope.
Yes, I'm sorry, you got cut off for a second.
Yes, you did. I heard a... Yeah, I was just asking you about, where we go from here, given that neither Marco Rubio or indeed Donald Trump appears satisfied with Panamanian explanations.
Well, I think it's not surprising what Marco Rubio said. He's playing to Donald Trump, and he's going to have to use some threatening language. But hopefully there could be a deal that's worked out with the Panamanian government. The president of Panama, Molino, is right to say that that Panama will retain control over the canal. But I think there are ways that they could try to reach a deal that would retain that control, but that would also reduce the influence of China. And I think they're taking steps in that direction. There's a concession with a Chinese company that is being reviewed. Hopefully the United States could bid on that, and therefore the United States would be much more engaged and begin to try to calm things down and reach some agreement that Trump could claim is a political victory, and that would keep the canal in Panama's hands.
Okay, Michael, we're on a slightly dodgy line, but let's persist for the moment. And you talk about a concession, and is that one that enables a Hong Kong-based company to operate two ports either end of the canal?
Yes, this was one that was renegotiated, a new concession in 2021, and there have been charges made of corruption that was involved in that. So I think it was under the previous government, not under the current government. So I think if that's investigated and then that concession is reopened, the problem in the past is that the United States has not been very interested in making bids on these, and the Chinese have. They've been very keen. And the United States is not. And hopefully one positive effect that could come out of this, now the United States would make the bids, and I think the Panamanian government would be happy to oblige. And that, I think, is one way that that I think Trump could point to a major advance in keeping the Chinese at bay.
If you're still with us, Michael, are you still with us? No. We have just lost... Michael Shifter, senior fellow of the US-based think tank Inter-American Dialogue, who was talking to us about Panama's relations with the United States and indeed China. The Grammys are happening in a few hours' time in Los Angeles. The Recording Academy Awards are the most prestigious in the music industry, but with Los Angeles still recovering from devastating wildfires, the build-up to the event has been scaled back. Tens of thousands of people lost their homes and livelihoods during the devastating fires last month, including a number of celebrities and musicians. Here's our LA correspondent, Emma Vardy.
There's been an outpouring from the music industry in the wake of the fires.
This one's for you, Los Angeles! Yeah.
This week, artists including Dr. Dre and Billie Eilish were among a star-studded lineup at two benefit concerts in LA, with all the proceeds going to the rebuilding process.
We'll laugh again. We're going to listen to music again.
Billy Crystal, who lost his home in the Palisades fire, said LA will recover.
We're Los Angeles, one city, one heart. LA strong!
Usually, the week leading up to the Grammys are filled with lavish parties. But this year, they've been cancelled in favour of low-key events to help more money be directed to supporting those who lost their homes. At a brunch for people in the music industry, Danny Chavez, an artist manager, told me it's difficult to find anyone who hasn't been touched by the disaster.
I know multiple musicians who lost their gear, something as simple as that. I know stylists who work in the music who have lost their houses that had costumes and whatnot. I know musicians who are born and raised in LA who lost their house.
Eileen Kazarian, a creative director, said holding the awards so close to the disaster could be a bad look for the industry.
I actually don't think that the Grammys should be happening. It's just very weird to me that there are going to be celebrities, you know, walking on the red carpet wearing very expensive clothes while people in other parts of the city are suffering and whose livelihoods have been destroyed.
Outside LA's crypto arena, the final touches are being put in place for the ceremony. And the red carpet has been rolled out in front of me here, and I can see workers carrying bottles of champagne into the stadium. Now, there have been doubts over whether the Grammy should happen at all, but the Recording Academy has justified its decision, saying the evening will double as a charitable event to raise money and honour the emergency teams who risk their lives.
This ain't Texas.
So perhaps the biggest question is whether Beyoncé will finally win an award for Best Album. As the most nominated artist in Grammy's history, but having repeatedly missed out on this accolade.
And I love you, it's ruining my life.
But she's up against Taylor Swift, who's won this category now four times.
You got a lot of nerve, don't you, baby?
And Post Malone with eight nominations. It's also tipped to be a night of success for up-and-coming artists, with a number of nominations for Chappell Roan and Charlie XCX. While fires continue to burn across LA County, for now the show will go on, and the music industry is keen to strike the right note.
That report from our Los Angeles correspondent, Emma Vardy. Thousands of people braved freezing weather at the annual Groundhog Day, an event in Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, on Sunday morning. You're probably familiar with Groundhog Day, more so as the name of a hit 90s film starring Bill Murray, but the tradition stretches back for centuries. The forecast works like this. If Phil the groundhog emerges from his hole and sees his shadow, he's predicted six more weeks, of wintry conditions. If Phil doesn't see his shadow, he's predicted an early spring.
It's Punxsutawney Phil!
There's a shadow up here. Get ready for 6 more weeks of winter this year!
So Punxsutawney Phil has predicted 6 more weeks of winter, which is perhaps less of a problem if you're in the Southern Hemisphere. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Among the flurry of executive orders that President Trump signed last month, the day after taking office, was one calling for a 90-day pause on foreign aid programs. The order got less attention than some of the others he signed that day, but it may have much more far-reaching consequences. Well, later in January, the Secretary of State issued a directive that went even further, effectively freezing operations at the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. No new projects were to be started, no contracts were to be extended, and work was to be stopped on most existing programs. Apoorva Mandavilli is a global health reporter with the New York Times and has been covering the aid freeze from the start.
The entire thing started on January 20th, which was essentially the beginning of the Trump administration. It was one of the first things he signed, as you pointed out, and it was sweeping. It seemed to include just about everything that the U.S. does abroad. And so people were extremely confused about what it actually included. And then the very next day, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said it wasn't meant to be destructive or punitive. And yet, I think that's exactly what it turned out to be. Over the next few days, people were told to stop working on every single thing that they did, medicine for things like HIV, malnutrition camps, you name it. And so all of a sudden, people didn't know exactly how to access the money. Everything was shut off. And so they had to start laying off their workers and everything ground to a halt.
So the people providing the money, providing the aid, were no longer doing their jobs.
They were told to stop doing their jobs. They actually received what's called stop work orders. They were told to stop doing everything they were doing, to stop distributing medicines, to stop diagnosing people, to stop even doing prevention work, anything and everything. And so people were actually told to go home. And at the same time, employees here in the U.S. at the CDC and at USAID were told not to talk to anybody. So if people abroad had questions, they had no one to ask.
So how much money is involved and directed to which parts of the world?
Well, so the entire aid budget is about $70 billion, which is about 1% of the country's budget. So we're not talking about huge amounts of money for the U.S., but it's enormous amounts of money for a lot of these places. And a lot of the medical work that happens does happen in Africa and in some parts of Asia. And even within that, there's some variability. So you mentioned South Africa earlier. There, the HIV programs rely on USAID for about 20%. But then you look at a country like Mozambique, they rely on aid for about 80% of their HIV budget. So it really depends. But some countries are going to be just absolutely devastated by this.
But there has been some kind of reprieve. Is that right? The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has signed a waiver. How does that work?
Yeah, so in that first week after the pause, there was this grinding to a halt. And so people were absolutely panicked and there was a lot of backlash. And they were told to stop distributing HIV drugs and that got a bit of a backlash. And so on Tuesday, January the 28th, so it's 8 days after the initial pause, Secretary of State Marco Rubio issued this waiver. But it was quite vague. It said that they would now allow life-saving humanitarian assistance, including essential medicines. And of course, that sounds like now you can give medicines for lots of things. But because it didn't spell out exactly what that was, people were terrified to make the wrong move. And so even though it sounded like, for example, distributing HIV drugs was okay, no one did it. They just did not want to make a wrong move and then have everything get shut down later on. And so people did not distribute HIV drugs, even for children.
Apoorva Mandavilli, a global health reporter with the New York Times. Well, among the programs affected by the freeze on foreign aid is what's known as the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. So what effect has that had on HIV/AIDS treatment in South Africa? I've been speaking to Professor Ntobeko Ntusi, President and CEO of the South African Medical Research Council.
The recent disruption to these programs has had a significant impact immediately on operations on the ground. Just to give you an example of the scale of PEPFAR, for instance, so South Africa receives about 20% of the annual disbursement from PEPFAR, which comes to about $350 million. The PEPFAR program employs over 250,000 doctors in 55 countries and over 1 million nurses and community healthcare workers. And with the stop work orders received between the 24th and 27th of January, all these staff members were immediately told to cease operations, 15 to 20,000 of them based in South Africa. And this meant that patients primarily with HIV infections who need to receive life-saving antiretroviral therapy as well as other treatments could no longer access their therapies. And the same has been true for other programmatic care programs. And as you can imagine, this has caused a significant furor around the country. Many people have rallied to try and get the U.S. administration to change its position. And on Friday, you will have heard that they've issued a waiver now saying that the continued treatment of HIV will now be permitted under U.S. aid and PEPFAR programs.
So there was a brief interruption to the treatment that was available. And what were the consequences of that for the treatment of patients living with HIV/AIDS?
Patients with HIV need to take their antiretroviral therapy daily. And what this does is to keep the immune system functioning optimally and the levels of the virus in the body suppressed. And once you have an interruption in your treatment, the levels of the virus begin to increase. And this increases your risk of opportunistic infections and cancers. But most importantly, you need to sustain a steady level of the drugs in your system. And when these are dip below a critical threshold for sustained or repeated periods, you can then develop resistance to the antiretroviral therapy as the HIV virus mutates, resulting in decreased efficacy of the treatment.
So it'd be true to say that there are probably a lot of HIV/AIDS patients whose treatment has been compromised.
Indeed, yeah. Patients who needed a refill of their medication in the last week could not access services and could not receive treatment. My hope is that with the waiver issued on Friday, from tomorrow onwards, many of the services will be recontinued.
That was Professor Ntobeko Ntusi, President and CEO of the South African Medical Research Council, ending this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want
truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.